welcome to Genesis Volatility Podcast. I'm here with Julian. He's a market maker and position trader prop trader in the crypto vol space, mostly focused on Deribit. Julian, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you, Greg.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you've been one of the OG market makers on Deribit since essentially the early days of crypto vol trading. So super excited to have you on and sort of get your perspectives. And then you also have a background in electricity trading, which is, I mean, if market making is, you know, in the shadows and electricity trading is super in the shadows, no one knows about that. So I was thinking maybe we could just touch on your background, how you got into trading, sort of your time trading electricity, and how you made your way over to crypto vol.
Sure. Yeah, so basically, after I finished university, I was looking to go into trading somehow, and I found a role as an analyst in an energy trading shop. And it was actually a pretty big electricity trading desk. I think one of the biggest in the world, I guess, from RWE Supply and Trading. And they were really prop traders at core, at least the team where I was. And I was an analyst there. So I was really like, I was in kind of a training program where different rotations, and they were really taking positions, having like small teams dedicated trading electricity in all kind of different markets. Basically, they were covering every country in Europe. They were trading electricity in the US, and just setting up a desk to trade electricity in Australia. So literally, they were like active everywhere. And that was basically where I first got in touch into trading, you could say. My role as an analyst, so I was just, you know, doing some, I would say, boring stuff right now. because as an analyst, you have to do analysis, you crunch some numbers, you come up with the fundamental analysis, and I learned my way into kind of trading and analysis and fundamental analysis and electricity markets in particular.
That's super interesting. So the electricity markets, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is there's no like listed markets. Does that mean it's just like all OTC, or is there like a listed contract somewhere for traders to like de-risk or hedge positions? How does that?
A lot of it is OTC, but there's also some listed contracts. It's just that they all have physical delivery, and it's not that easy to get access to these. Like, I remember the exchange, but. And also, the electricity market has basically two different types. So basically, the desk I was just talking about, where my first job was, that was really trading focused on futures and forwards, so and options. And this stuff was, it was obviously standardized and was trading at. I mean, some futures are even trading on ICE, but they're not accessible to everyone. And the ones on ICE are really illiquid, so. The biggest exchange is actually in Germany, was the EEX exchange. So you could trade baseload power futures there. So futures usually with delivery for the next year, baseload. And then there's like peak load futures. There's all kind of different types of futures, of tenors. And also then the delivery is also pretty special because since you cannot store electricity, it's usually a delivery over a period. Like over a whole year. So it is, I would say, very complicated, not very easy, not accessible to somebody who wants to trade, like just do proper trading from his own account or so. Like you need to have a balancing circle, it's called, in order to, it's very complicated. But that was also only the first time I got in touch with electricity markets, because that was, my first job straight out of university, and I really had no idea at the time like what it's all about. It was surely interesting, but a couple of years later, I would work somewhere else at a different company, and there I was trading. I had a trading role then. I was spot trading, like intraday trading electricity in the short term markets, and that was really, I would say, the more interesting of these two jobs. It was really fulfilling or adding to the, and completing my knowledge, basically, if you want to put it this way, because what I did there was, the company I was working for, we were we manage a big portfolio of power stations, and we would have to balance it. So with electricity supply and demand and the overall market, they've always to be matched. So whenever you you generate electricity, you have to basically make sure that you produce what you set to the balancing cycle manager, basically what you're going to produce. So basically you have all the time to, you all the time have to sometimes like buy power if you're missing some, you look at the weather forecast, you like it has a lot of physicality involved. You can turn on power stations and turn them off again. You have like 14 screens in front of you and to monitor all the kind of different stuff, what's happening. And it's a shift job. So you have to do this 24/7 around the clock. So you're taking shifts, taking turns with all the other creators. And your goal is always to balance the position to make sure that you don't have any excess energy and you don't have, and you don't lack energy. So basically you have to make sure that the portfolio is balanced at all times. So that was a super interesting job. Obviously it was even more complex than the first job in trading in futures. But it was very different because it was very physical. You wouldn't be able to take big positions because the products that you trade, they're intraday, so they have such a brief time span. You know, it's like a pure, really physical market. So I would say there was, of course, there was some speculation involved, but way less interesting than the one on the longer term markets.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So it sounds like, if I'm an analyst on the long-term markets, it looks like I got to like secure contracts to provide for a year. And like the things I'm looking at are maybe political situations, weather situations, maybe plants going down, stuff like that, kind of forecasting that. But on the intraday basis, it sounds a lot more like making sure that everything runs perfectly. Like there's like you said, the demand and the supply are constantly matching. And it's a little bit more of like a, making sure things are well organized. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like for example, on the short term, you might have things impact the price, in particular weather and weather changes when there are storms or anything like that. When there are outages, you're immediately affected by this. Like this is stuff which has heavy impact directly on the spot market. And then there are like, for example, on the longer term market, weather of course has an impact, but it's way less extreme than, for example, on the very short term, where it can just, you know, change your whole situation. They are two different components, very physically driven, but obviously both also have some speculation component. Although the first job, really, like the longer term trading, that is really one where big speculation was going on, where you could really take positions and all that kind of stuff, or the traders took positions.
Yeah, that's super interesting. That actually makes me think, like you said, the weather in the short term versus long term almost makes me think of vol a little bit. Whereas like one day vol can go crazy, can pretty much hit any sort of level. And then long dated vol is a lot slower moving. And one day of a spike or one day of a weather spike is not going to change the 1 year vol that much. I mean, maybe that's not a good analogy, but that's kind of what it makes me think of. So kind of moving on.
Yeah,
here,
kind of. It makes kind of sense, I would say.
So moving on here, like how did you find yourself from the electricity market going into the crypto vol space? Like what was that transition like for you?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So basically, I always wanted to do something on my own, and I was always trading on my own account, equities, in particular equity options. I would just, you know, punt on some calls or stuff, or buy puts or sales runners. Like I was just doing some very basic stuff, but I didn't really have a game plan for this, but in particular during the time when I was shift trading electricity, I was really hustling a lot. So I was working, I was programming trading algorithms for the company I was working for. So I would write bots that could do different stuff in the markets. I would also because I would have night shifts. You know, during night shifts you have pretty much. Usually there's not a lot to do. Sometimes there is, but usually your night shifts are like night shifts, whatever, in whatever your job you do, it's always the same kind of. And so I was using a lot of my spare time I had to look into other stuff. So actually, I discovered cryptos this way. So because I was trading options, I was looking for an options exchange for cryptos, and that's how I found Deribit, basically. So it was the only options, really, options exchange that was interesting. There was, they were basically the only ones. And I met at the company I was working for, I met my co-founder, two of my co-founders, basically, I met there. So I was with the idea to launch an operation together, if you want to put it this way, just to try to do something. Like, my co-founder, Victor, he is a super good developer. At least, well, he's not a developer, but he's an engineer, but he's a very smart guy. And he was pretty quick at setting up APIs and connect to things. And I was I'm more the creative guy, coming up with ideas about bots or whatever how our system could look like and design it. And basically, we had the vision to start market making on Deribit. And that's kind of how we started. So we would just write very small programs to show bids and asks at the time when there were not many other market makers. And from there, we basically grew the book, and that basically at some point became so big that we ventured on our own.
That's fantastic. So now you do both prop trading and market making, but kind of before you move to prop trading, like from a market maker's perspective, so you obviously had to build a lot of infrastructure to, you know, post quotes and things like that. So are you guys constantly posting quotes across the book? Is that part of the deal to be a market maker? And how do you manage sort of that risk and that inventory? And as a market maker, not a prop trader, do you ever have a bias that you want to tilt your book a certain way? Or are you really just trying to minimize risk and collect bid and ask spreads?
It really depends. So I would definitely say we are not your typical market maker, because I would say by definition, a market maker tries to take zero risk, always have the position flat, kind of tries to basically just collect the spread. But because we had no market making background, with everything we did basically is stuff we came up by ourselves. So all my decision making was always based, revolving very much around my two jobs that I had, in particular actually the first one, which was just prop trading. So basically the idea was, okay, we see these spreads on options, they're pretty wide, let's try to quote these and see where we get filled. That's literally how it started. So we would just quote. We didn't even have a wall surface. We would just write a bot that would, you know, fill the order books, show bids and asks. And in the beginning of that was working out pretty well. And at some point, we figured out, okay, we need some more higher mass. We need some wall models or so. So to quote a bit smarter, at least to create a wall surface on which we can quote. And basically we did this then later. So in the beginning we were quoting 24/7 around the clock. It was just three of us, and we had no smart logic in how to manage the inventory. We would have limits. At some point our bots get filled, we sold too much, we bought too much, and they just stopped quoting one side. And then we tested around different stuff, whether the bot would lean its quotes to one side or the other depending on the inventory that he gets filled. But at some point we figured out that got a bit complex, and it's a science of its own, you could say. So and others were doing it better than we do, certainly. So we figured out, well, the bot is still useful, but we can use it actually to build positions as well. So we would have, like, one the first task that we basically did, even before building any bot, was building a position, if you want to call it the system, with which we can display our position and display all of our risk factors that we have in the book. And from that moment on, you could already say we were kind of aiming to do market making, but we were also aiming to manage this position. You could say that every single day we have a view on the market. We look at fundamentals. We look at the sentiment. We look at technicals. We look at all kind of different stuff. And you could say there every day we make our mind up, like, where the price should be, if it should go higher, if it should go lower, where it could be. And then we try to shape our position through vols and deltas and gammas in a way that it kind of matches our own view, so to speak. And there are often like inefficiencies coming up. Sometimes you see stuff on the vol side, just purely on the vol side, which is interesting to play. It's like that basically how our trading approach evolved. In the beginning, basically we were showing quotes 24/7, but then as the competition picked up, we couldn't run the bots anymore at night alone. And at some points, we started to just quote when we actually awake. And currently, we are rebuilding our system a bit and redesigning it to quote a bit more frequently again. But yeah, we are not always quoting nowadays. We're just quoting if we feel like if we want to have a position or if we feel like it's the right environment to. It depends always on, depends also on our systems, on the state of our systems. Because, that needs to, you immediately feel it in the crypto space. If you stop building, you get overrun by the competition because they don't stop. So at some point we also like, especially like in the last 2 years, we noticed that the prop trading approach, like taking positions, forming views and expressing these through options is just for us had a bigger leverage at some point because, we are just, three of us or now the two of us. And, it's just too much work to code on a good system and at the same time make mark. Like I'm still surprised that we still managed show quotes these days, but, sometimes it happens.
That's fascinating. And I love the perspective that you're sort of overlaying your own opinions on top of, especially in the early days on top of your market making book, because it almost allows you to like get into a position, getting paid to get in a position essentially by quoting and collecting bid and asks and then getting paid to get out. So it's a nice way to like minimize costs, put your view in into the market. And if you're right, then also make money on that side. I like that a lot. So one of the things that's pretty interesting that you mentioned is that if you're not moving fast, the competition's moving fast. And I really feel that in crypto. It's like everything moves in dog years. 1 year is really like 7 years of TradFi. And so over the years, how have you seen the competition as far as others competing with quote listing on Deribit or maybe making markets on Paradigm? Is that something somewhere where you also used to offer or still do RFQs or global RFQs on Paradigm?
Yeah, let's try to structure it a little bit. So we started by purely screen market making on Deribit, showing quotes on the screen. Then at some point came the OTC exchange cleared market through Paradigm. So that was a super interesting market, is a super interesting market, especially in the beginning. Obviously, it was super hot because there were just few market makers and we had like you could have a pretty significant market share by showing quotes. And if you take these big quotes and you don't have a high-end system, actually you have to take the risk in your own books and then you have to warehouse that. So basically, let's assume during Asian hours there comes a guy on Paradigm and he wants to buy a lot of Vega for some reason. He wants to maybe buy outright calls, like a classic. So you sell in these calls, you collect an edge versus the mid price. Obviously, the quote will be so big that they move the vaults a bit. So now you have to warehouse that position and you have to make sure that when you, you have to make sure that over the lifetime until that position is solved basically or expired, you generate P&L on that more than like at least that it makes up for, at least that you've collected at least the spread. But, it's not a very easy task. And I would say there's also no exact way on how to do it. I assume you can build a system and I assume the people are showing 24/7 quotes in Deribit and there are some like block tech and so forth. I assume that they do everything completely automated and when they get filled somewhere, they try to offset these these risk factors as big as possible. So they're able actually to short quotes everywhere. But yeah, we were having these quotes and these positions then in the book and had to deal with it. And yeah, so started with screen, then came paradigm. And that's kind of where we are still right now. Obviously, the suit of our strategies has changed over the time because there were different opportunities. Sometimes there were cross exchange future spreads that were super interesting, in particular in the early days of FTX. Then at some point, especially in the last 2 years, just being long actually was trading cryptos from the long side was pretty juicy, especially or being gamma long. I remember also like a time which was pretty interesting was when Putsky was negative. It's something which I had never seen before ever on anything. It was 2019, and we would see literally that puts would trade way below at the money options. And yeah, these were also places where as a market maker or as a vol trader, when you see this for the first time, you will start to really lift the shit out of these puts because they're just so cheap, if you want to put it this way. And in hindsight, actually, it's an interesting fact because we bought these puts in really giga enormous size, I would say, and they all ended up being out of the money. And the seller was probably very happy that he sold them because he made some money on this. But for us, actually, we were also pretty happy because all the time we had like really nice slides in our book. We had books because our downside was covered so well that would allow us to run other risks. So that's kind of how it works or how it worked for us. And yeah, that's what I can say to that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting because I remember when we first started building GVOL, there was a lot of risk to the call side. Like all the skew was being priced to the call side, so calls were a lot more expensive. And we would see weird things like flat put skew, where you could like buy a 5 delta put for the same vol as a 15 delta put and structure weird things like that. Now, over your evolution, how have you seen the vol surface change? Do you think that the vol surface got more efficient nowadays? Or was it always efficient and just the characteristics of the market changed? And when you started market making, how many market makers do you think were on Deribit versus how many do you think are now?
It's like, okay, so the space has evolved a lot. Like the number of market makers is enormous right now. And also the sophistication of the players is extreme. In the beginning, there were like literally 5, 6, 7 people, 7 bigger traders, I would say, market makers. But now, then people came over from TradFi and from other vol trading desks, just venturing out into crypto vol, and it got really, the space got really tight, I would say. And then also the inefficiencies on the vaults were like insane in the last years, really insane. Like, for example, there was this one moment where it was a pretty prominent one. I think I posted something on Twitter too. It was when Rob Paul was like pitching a play to buy some really high upside calls on Ether. I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't remember which strike it was, but it was basically a bet that price will go parabolic. And the thing is, as a payoff player, it made sense at the time to take this trade potentially. As a vol player, you could already sell him or sell this strike because so many people were jumping on that trade that strike was just going more expensive than you would have then. Like as a vol trader, you would just see different strikes that actually give you a very similar profile, but have to be managed actively because maybe they expire early. So you would have to roll them and so forth. So, you could basically rebuild the same position that Rob Paul had a lot cheaper, but also costing a lot of maintenance by managing it. So we were doing that in size. And at some point, it got just so extreme that that was probably a really obvious play of something that was inefficient. And these type of inefficiencies, especially during the bull run, were pretty common. And I would say it's also a normal thing to happen because during the bull run, everybody's happy, everybody's long, everybody's taking positions. You don't care too much about execution because you make money anyway. It's just going up. And it's an environment which creates obviously a lot of opportunities for everybody. Bull markets, the bear market, on the other hand, is like something way more difficult because it's the opposite of that, basically. And especially in the phase where we are right now, where the initial dump, at least let's hope the initial dump is over. We were now going sideways for a couple of months. And you can see that all these opportunities definitely vanish. Like, there are still some, but very small, very nimble compared to what we had in the last years. And I think adding something to it is that there are also a lot of market makers and a lot of ball players entering the space. So it really got more competitive, way more competitive.
Yeah,
than in the past.
That's super interesting. And the Raoul Paul Real Vision recommendation for those who are new to the space, $25,000 March 2022 strikes were going crazy on Ethereum. So that's a great point for someone who's maybe new to vol trading, is that, you know, that creates a kink in the surface, and you as a market maker or as a vol trader can go ahead and replicate that same payout profile at a cheaper price. That's a great insight on how to do that. So, go ahead.
Yeah, that's trying to explain it in a very simplified way, if you want to put it this way. Like, in the reality, what it looks like, I mean, it at least how we would do it is we would sell the strike, and at some point we would show offers all the time, maybe through our market making, and we will say, like, we will calibrate the bots in a way that they will just keep selling the strike when we get hit, but obviously shift the bots a bit higher. And at some point, the question is, how much risk do you want to take into your book? So what we do is, you could say we manage our book from a day-to-day basis. So we have a view where we see the slides of our books, of our book, the scenarios, what happens with our book and our P&L if the price goes up by 1%, 2%, 3%, and so forth, up to 100%, and the same on the downside. And we want, usually, let's say the best way is always to have sort of clean slides. So whatever happens, actually, you're in a pretty good position. But sometimes, obviously, you want to be in a very good position when price goes up, or you want to deliberately leave slides to the downside open or to the upside open. So if you have really like strong views in something, and there you would just sell it, and then you would look into your slides and you would think like, okay, am I still happy with the risk factors that I have in the book? So maybe in the beginning it was just selling in the cards and just doing nothing because maybe you had some gamma on the front that was covering it. And at some point you would do other stuff. And so it's just, you could say as a vol trader or as a vol market maker, probably by buying and selling options, you get paid for basically managing these positions at all the time. Because a position trader, you know, he can take on now long and just sell it again, and then he's done with his position. But as a market maker, you have positions everywhere. You have kind of positions on every strike. You have risk factors always in the book, and these risk factors even change over time. So sort of, you could say one edge of trading vol can, or one part of the edge of trading vol is by dealing with all this mathematical optimization or type of stuff around it. So,
That makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of infrastructure costs to get to the point where you can see everything and map it out and have a good risk matrix and price things appropriately and stuff like that. That's an interesting point. So real quick, kind of just moving on to sort of the next thing here, is that now you're doing some positional trading. And where do you see sort of your future? Do you think you're going to go straight to positional and just stop with market making? Or is that something that's always going to be part of your book?
I mean, let's be honest, like in the past 2 years, we did way more positional trading than we did market making, like by a big margin. In the beginning, we tried to separate it and also separate the P&L, like, because you kind of want to know where your edge is coming from, right? So let's assume I have a small long position during the bull market and I do some market making. And in the end of the day, I look at my P&L and see it's up but it might be difficult to determine if it was actually coming from market making or just from the long positions, the long bias that I had on. So we were always struggling to find out exactly where it was coming from. And that is part of building the system and designing something which kind of works for us. I would say it's really difficult to say because it's just, it was just three of us and now it's just two of us building stuff. And there's you could say we have a game plan of things that we want to achieve, but you could always say it's not, we never had this fully fleshed market making game plan of just doing this and nothing else. So, it is,
that makes sense. And now we're in a situation, we have ETH merge, ETH 2.0 merge, people call it. So that's actually coming up here very soon, next, call it 24 hours. And so, you know, what we've seen over the past few years is really interesting. We've seen a huge explosion in open interest in the ETH markets. We actually see more ETH open interest on Deribit than Bitcoin now. You know, what do you make of maybe ETH versus Bitcoin vol and sort of this kind of event? Like, is this something that you have an edge in just because you've been in the crypto space, you have a good idea, you've seen forks before, you've seen stuff like this before, or is it kind of the TradFi players still have a good edge from having, you know, market making expertise?
Sure. First of all, let's talk in general about the vol spread between ETH and BTC. So the spread is moving, and it was sometimes negative and sometimes very positive, like is it right as it was right now. And in realized vol terms, it can go completely, like can be a 100% vol difference between these two. Like they can be massive. So obviously, what we've done is we've done a couple of analysis in the past. We've looked at it, and at some point we also in the past took positions on this. So we would buy ETH Gamma, ETH Vega, and sell BTC Vega against it and all that kind of stuff. But it's something which is really difficult to manage, mm-hmm. because there it involves so many parameters. Because kind of you need to have enough liquidity to sell these vaults and buy these vaults. You have to make sure that you don't pay too much slippage. You probably can't do everything as a taker. So you might have to be passive a bit. And if you're passive in building the position, then you're also kind of dependent on the order flow which comes in. So kind of sometimes you might actually not be able to build a position because the order flow never comes. So there's a lot of nuances involved with it. So it was to us at least never a really straightforward thing. What we see now in the past couple of months is that there was a really Ether vaults have been really picking up, and BTC vaults not so much. And BTC was also not moving out so much as ETH at least. So, there's a point where I would say, yeah, at some point it seemed that ETH vaults are way too expensive compared to BTC vaults. But now with the merge coming up, that's such a special occasion, I would say. Like, I don't know, I just saw that daily's options are almost trading at 200%. It's like, and the price didn't move at all today. So it's literally all like probably positioning into the merge and expectation of vol. So we'll see what happens. I guess my assumption would be that after the merge, depending if there's a new trend coming up or not to either side, but let's say the base assumption is that after the merge, the market continues with a price action of the past months, then I would say, yeah, well, it should probably converge again. But it always depends really on what the next thing will be. And that's also like what I meant in the beginning of the podcast, that continuously we make a forecast about about the price and about we continuously make price expectations and wall expectations and all that kind of thing. We do that on a daily basis because it can change pretty often. Like sometimes might be that tomorrow we think it's the other way and then we start unwinding positions, and then day afterwards we see, oh, that was a mistake, and we go back the other way. So like it's really not straightforward.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting. So, kind of last question here, just wrapping up. I mean, obviously, you're a busy guy. Now you guys are a two-person team. So, where do you find time to do stuff outside of trading? I know most traders, including myself, are obsessed with trading, but do you find some time outside of trading to do other activities? And if so, what do you do for fun?
I have family, so it's taking a lot of time. But then also, sometimes I do I can I do some skating, I do surfing when I'm out somewhere in Europe. I
Skateboarding?
attempt myself in all kinds of different sports, but I've never been a very consistent guy with this stuff. I would say, I do some skating, I do some surfing. It's probably the most consistent stuff I've done in the past. So, yeah, that's
That's
what I do.
awesome. That well, you'll have to go skating with my co-founder sometime. He's pretty good. So, awesome. Well, Julian, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Thank you for everyone who tuned in, and we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, man.